You're listening to an iHeart podcast.
Something unexpected happened after Jeremy Scott confessed to killing Michelle Schofield in Bone Valley season one.
Every time I hear about my dad, it's, oh, he's a killer. He's just straight evil.
I was becoming the bridge between Jeremy Scott and the son he'd never known.
At the end of the day, I'm literally a son of a killer.
Listen to new episodes of Bone Valley Season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's April 2020. A woman announces on Facebook that she has COVID and won't be seeking medical attention.
I didn't want to be talked out of this plan.
Then she disappears.
Anyone else think this is strange?
I just had to know. How did this happen?
Listen to What Happened to Talina Czar on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my new true crime podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to 1964, to the cold case of artist Mary Pinchot Meyer.
She had been shot twice, in the head and in the back.
It turns out Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on Dear Chelsea with me, Chelsea Handler, Connie Britton is here.
I think you should encourage your friend to go ahead and not be holding out for any man to have her babies. She could be waiting another 10 years before she finds the right guy. Connie didn't meet her right guy until you were what, 50, Connie?
52. I kept thinking, oh, I'm going to meet the guy. I finally was like, what am I waiting for? And I did it. And I'm just so glad that I did.
Listen to Dear Chelsea on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Zoom lady has commanded us, and we are back. This is Behind the Bastards, the podcast that exists entirely to glorify, elevate, and worship the Zoom lady, our only god and master. And in fact, the only thing sacred in our entire cosmology of universal ethics. My guest today, Archbishop of the Zoom Lady, Miles Gray. Miles, praise her.
Oh, praise be to the ZL, the Zoom Lady that is, for without her contributions to our mortal galaxy, we would have nothing. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on, Miles. And thank you for creating the first religious schism in our new cult that will eventually turn into a war that kills billions, which is, of course, whether or not we can abbreviate the Zoom Lady's name to ZL.
To the ZL.
Yeah,
I know. And we've talked about this off mic. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you come with your people, I'll come with mine, and I guess we'll see who's alive in the end.
Yes. I am excited for when we both gain access to nuclear silos and can really, really take this disagreement over theology to an apocalyptic level.
Oh, but, I mean, I think that's the one thing we both agree on, and we're excited for. Secretly,
we are.
We don't care who wins.
It's just about the joy of starting a nuclear war, Miles.
It's just about doing that thing we saw during a mushroom trip where we're like, dude, what if you saw a mushroom cloud right in front of you, though?
Wouldn't that be rad?
And look at us, our Zoom lady cult now.
Praise be. So, Miles, when we were talking last time, if you remember, you might have forgotten.
That's right.
Some kids spanked a girl so badly she lost control of her bowels and had to be hospitalized.
Yes.
Because everything in Elon was done communally, including physical punishments, which we're going to talk about a lot more today. There's a lot. Oh, it gets so much worse, Miles. So much worse. So, by the mid-70s, Elon had moved to the facility it would occupy for the majority of its existence in Poland Springs. Most of its residents lived on the five-acre facility, which included Elon 1, an administrative trailer, and six other numbered buildings that acted as dormitories, classroom space, etc. There were two other Elon facilities, including one in Parsonfield, Maine, that had once been a TB sanitarium. The space for all these facilities was necessary, or all of this space was necessary, because in the early 70s, Elon got a bunch of positive press reports, which brought hundreds of new residents to the program. So, again, Yeah.
What are positive press what's a positive press resort for this guy?
That this is saving kids whose lives are completely out of control. That this will give you back your kid. This will get them off of drugs. You know, nothing is worse than having a kid who's a drug addict. So anything Alon does is just. And the idea that this is like the best kind of treatment for them. Like this specific program is, Joe Ritchie billed it as the Rolls Royce of teen treatment programs.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And I remember even like, because this is even like with Kellogg, right? Like all the just wacky remedies that were, you know, just essentially ways to fuck people up. Mm-hmm. Were there at least success stories that they would be like, oh, and then check out this kid who, stopped neighing like a horse?
Yes. Throughout the existence of the program, there are kids who will claim it'll save their life. There's even some kids who hated it, but also will say like, it saved my life because I was like really into heroin and I probably would have OD'd without it. It also has permanently damaged my brain. Like, like that, like the positive stories tend to be like, I would have died without it. Also, I am forever like changed because of this program in ways that are profoundly like negative and complex. And,
right.
Like,
I feel deeply disconnected from who I used to be.
This is not to say there are some positive stories and we can speculate on some of those people.
Sure.
But when you go through reports of people who were there, the overwhelming reports are not positive. Now, that said, this is the early 70s. Nobody's talking about this place online. You don't have a lot of former kids coming out. And a lot of these kids, it's a mix of rich kids who go there. And generally, if you're rich, you do get some kind of special treatment, right? And wards of the state. And so nobody cares what the wards of the state say.
Right.
And nobody's really able to check up on them to tell whether or not they actually have a high success rate, which we're going to talk about in a bit. So it was certainly the popular perception that the Alon School was like, again, the Rolls Royce, like this is the nicest place you can send a kid for this kind of intense rehab facility. It's at this beautiful compound in the woods in Maine. Like it's like a summer camp, you know, that was kind of the way this was marketed. Now, 1975 was a key year in the evolution of the Alon School. It's the year where a number of the most questionable aspects of early Alon procedures started to turn toxic. And one possible catalyst for the growing toxicity of the Alon School may be the fact that Joe Ritchie had an increasingly severe drug addiction of his own. So Joe's friends seem to be pretty consistent that he was not a heroin addict as a kid, but whatever the truth was, his old injuries from his car accident started bothering him while he worked prior to opening the Alon School. And a number of his colleagues there mentioned to his wife that they were worried about how many pills he was taking. Sherry confronted him and he told her that he needed the pills because his pain was unbearable. Now, once the Alon School started, Joe kept using. Sherry eventually realized that Dr. Davidson, their business partner, was prescribing her husband opiates, which is, again, very ethical doctor here. She went to the doctor saying, hey, Joe is an addict and you should probably not give him a blank check for drugs. And he told her, hey, I know what I'm doing. Don't tell me how to do my job. I'm a psychiatrist.
Back off, lady. I'm running the Rolls Royce of abuse thunderdomes.
And one of the things that's interesting about this is that later on in like the late 90s, when Joe Ritchie stops working there most of the time, like he eventually, like the school is still running, but he's not really there most of the time, not involved in the day to day. The guy who replaces him running the program is also a heroin addict and is using actively while he's running the school.
Wow.
It's interesting. So Joe had a problem. Dr. Davidson did not know what he was doing. And although Joe didn't really drink much, his pill usage caused wild mood swings, irritable and abusive behavior. When he would have a mood swing, the easiest people for him to take it out on were the patients at his school. So by 1975, this was becoming a serious problem. And that same year, his 54-year-old father, Bamboo, shot one of his friends during a bar fight when his friend tried to de-escalate things after he called another patron the N-word. So Joe's dad goes to prison for shooting a dude. This is a bad year. 75 is a bad year for Joe Ritchie is the point I'm building towards. And on July 22nd, it got even worse. The state of Illinois sent a team of 5 investigators, a psychiatrist, and 4 social workers to Elon for a surprise evaluation. This was standard procedure when more than 10 wards of the state had been placed in a facility. So more than 10 kids from Illinois get sent to the Alon School and they say like, oh, we have to send a team up there to make sure that it's like a good school, you know? Very reasonable idea, right?
Yeah, why not?
The team stayed for 2 days. They talked with staff and residents, and they observed daily activities. Now, this was the first inspection Alon's school had, and so it came as a surprise, and as a result, they hadn't prepared ahead of time.
Oh, my God.
They hadn't cleaned anything up.
Take the signs down.
Oh, we gotta stop hitting the kids till they shit themselves.
What the fuck?
Turns out psychiatrists don't usually like that.
Oh, guys, we've been doing this all wrong according to them, so we gotta just pretend we don't do all this fucked up stuff.
So the team found a number of horrifying things. One staff member in charge of a house where 7 Illinois residents lived admitted he had a criminal history of assaulting women. His third such assault had seriously injured his victim, which is why he'd been sent to Elon before graduating and being hired as staff there. He admitted to investigators that he had difficulty relating to women and was monitored by other staff to make sure that he didn't assault any female residents.
Oh my God.
Now that might be a mark against you, you know? Maybe you shouldn't be in charge of a house full of teenagers, including teenage girls, if you have a history of repeatedly criminally assaulting women. Perhaps not, right? Maybe?
Yeah, yes. I don't think that's a part of the evaluation that most people realize in general that you don't want to be... Well, I guess I don't know whose fault that is. I mean, honestly, like they hired him. So
they did hire him.
And here's my truth. And they're like, oh,
here's my truth.
This is all bad.
I love criminally assaulting women. Well, good news about this job. So do we.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? And that's their fault for hiring you, honestly. Yeah.
Now, the investigators were also horrified by general meetings, the constant pattern of verbal abuse in Elon, and the frequency of spankings. They eventually found out that the resident director with a history of assaulting women had spanked numerous residents. So the staff had claimed, like, well, we make sure he doesn't assault women, even though he has a history of it. And then they were like, well, but yeah, but he gets to spank them.
He's using a paddle, okay? Yeah. It's professional. Like, what the fuck are they thinking?
Team members of this Illinois monitoring team overheard constant verbal assaults from staffers to residents, including lines like, you motherfucking whore, you cocksucking, titty-sucking, motherfucking asshole, and other things that did not seem like therapeutic criticism.
Oh, my God. This is so wild to me, though, that, like, you know how bad this is, where outside observers come in and it's become so normal that they're like, yeah, okay, back to our regular scheduled programming, which is just tearing people down verbally and, like, with the worst language.
Now, when they interviewed the nurse, she revealed that she had gotten vaginal smears and rectal exams from female residents before they started class, as well as semen samples from male residents. She said this was to test for VD. Semen samples were obtained by giving boys a small cup, directing them to a private room, and ordering them to masturbate. So the team from Illinois was like, this seems... not like the way you'd test for STDs. And they reached out to several doctors to be like, is it normal to get a cum sample from kids to test for STDs?
And all like, of the I'm doctors, sorry, what?
Yeah, that's exactly right. All the doctors are like, what in the fuck are you talking about? You don't need
Someone
semen
told
to
you
test
this
for
out
this.
Loud?
Yeah. You need to get this person away from children immediately.
What the fuck are you talking about? I almost fainted. Mm-hmm. I was at a, oh my God, what?
It's so fucked up. So the team from, the nurse also admitted to handing out controlled substances without prescriptions to kids.
For what?
For whatever. Mainly birth control pills, which were given upon request and without carrying out a physical exam first. Now, none of that's great, but what really freaked the investigators out was learning about the ring. Now, the ring has become one of the most infamous facts about Elon. The ring was a boxing ring where two people would beat each other up with gloves. But it was also a literal ring of people, Miles. The individual being punished would be forced to fight everyone in the ring, sometimes more than 10 people, so that even if they were good at fighting and big, they would eventually be overwhelmed by sheer exhaustion and beaten bloody. In interviews, when this became widely known later, Joe Ritchie claimed that the ring was only given as punishment to bullies who had used or threatened physical violence against others. His argument was that you had to show these people that there was always someone bigger than them. So that's what Joe claimed. Yeah.
Either way, no matter
either
what
way,
you
that's
say,
not how you teach children.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, just shut up right there, dude. Yeah. You're still, so you do admit you're making them fight each other in this fucking battle royale king of the hill format? Yeah, yeah, but hold on, hold on, hold on. The point is, no, there's no point.
Yeah,
the
I don't
point
care
is
about
that
your
you
reasoning.
These kids doing it, you fuck up.
Yeah. I don't care about your reasoning. You're making children fight in a ring.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you suggest?
So here's the reality the team from Illinois saw. I'm going to quote from Duck in a Raincoat again. Those used to defeat the person being punished were mostly large, well-built boys fighting both male and female residents. Oh, oh. Two residents independent. Oh, what? You're having issues
Are
already,
you
Miles?
Real?
Yeah. They'd pick the big kids for it. Two residents independently talked about a young female being forced into the ring. When she resisted, she was held down while residents attempted to tie boxing gloves on her hands. When that failed, she was sent into the ring barefisted and without headgear. Investigators also cited an incident where a pregnant girl was put in the ring and defeated.
Oh,
evaluators observed that...
Oh, my
that,
God. Yeah,
it's pretty bad.
What the fuck?
Evaluators observed that residents could be sent into the ring for any infraction, including not sharing in discussion groups. So no, not just bullies. If you don't want to talk in the group about who you have a crush on, you're going to get beaten up by large teenage boys in a circle.
Because you're not forthcoming with your pain in a fucking environment that is only meant to like exploit it and make you feel worse. And then you have to fucking be beat.
Yeah, beating a pregnant girl. This is, I mean, this is happening. This is happening in the 90s, Miles. This evaluation's 75, but the ring goes on for decades.
The ring goes, oh my God, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Please tell me, like, just this better have a fucking good ending, man.
It doesn't.
Motherfucker.
I mean, elements of it are good. So... We'll talk more.
What show do you think this is?
Fucking no.
We'll talk more about the ring later. Another punishment the investigator.
More?
Yeah, Miles. Oh, buddy. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we got to talk about the kid it killed. But first, we're going to talk about another punishment the investigators discovered, which might actually be worse. Now, this was called electric sauce. You want to know take a guess as to what electric sauce was, Miles?
Dude, no, that's so fucked up sounding.
Yeah, I know. Really bad. Quote. Wait. Yeah, Miles?
No, I don't even, I can't even.
Don't do it.
My brain's like short circuiting even trying to combine
the two words. It's a really bad school. Like, we've covered some bad, like, honestly, elements of this sound not as bad as the German school that raped all those kids. Like
the Waldorf school, right?
No, that was just the weird cult school.
You did. Yeah.
Ooh, yeah. So I'm going to
I mean, we've covered some bad schools. Between the residential schools.
Definitely not as bad as the residential schools.
Ireland,
but
I mean,
I guess the residential schools like killed thousands, right? So much worse. There's an element of this that is more disturbing just because of in those schools, they're killing kids systematically through neglect and through just a lack of caring about their health. This is obviously less horrible. It's not an act of genocide. But the level of thought Joe Ritchie put into how to craft this engine of child abuse, there's something like uniquely unsettling about it in a way that it hasn't been present before in any of these other schools. It's just such an intricately crafted machinery of child abuse. That's what's like so like the fuck about this to me.
Yeah.
Not trying to like play like which is worse than the obviously like again the genocide schools are worse, but there's something about this that's like primally unsettling, like the level of thought this man spent decades designing an engine to abuse children.
And again, like so many of these like stories that it's just repeating cycles of abuse because like he went to some
fucked up
place,
like who knows then, what the fuck happened at the place he went. Yeah.
Right.
Are you ready to finally learn about what the electric sauce was, Miles?
Oh, God, I'd forgotten about the title.
Yeah, we still haven't gotten into the electric sauce. Quote, electric sauce was the term used to describe a mixture of garbage, ketchup, mustard, cigarette butts, and other refuse, which was poured over a person's head as a form of punishment. The report indicated that human feces was sometimes included in this sauce.
What?
Yeah, they're shitting and coming into buckets and throwing in trash and pouring it on people's heads when they're bad.
And again, and if you're
this is therapy, by the way. State, yeah.
What is Richie saying?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. Oh, Richie, what does the electric fucking sauce do?
Richie denies that this is a part of the school, right? Like, this is not the kind of, he'll defend like the ring and stuff. And they do stop using the electric sauce ring. Eventually. Yeah. Because there's no defense of the electric sauce
than I would the ring. Yeah, if we're going to weigh the two.
It's good to know where your line is, Miles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, if I got to own one, I'm like, well, at least no kid's dying from being in a fist fight ring. Mm-hmm. And it's just straight up.
Well,
I mean, I don't even
actually,
know why I'm
trying to
act like one's better than the other.
Again, yeah.
Look at what this show's done to me.
I'm going to read you another fun quote about other punishments at the Elan School, Miles. Digging ditches was apparently still another reprimand. A day of digging ditches under surveillance was a common practice. After each ditch was dug, the resident being punished would be required to fill it back up again and repeat the process for the duration of the punishment. The use of handcuffs was also alleged. One resident explained that he had been handcuffed for about 5 hours for striking someone. Another had been ordered by a staff member to handcuff a girl to a table by placing the cuffs around her ankles. One of the Illinois wards had his shoes taken away. During his 6 weeks at Elan, he had made repeated requests for shoes, but the requests were denied because he was told that if he had shoes, he might run away. When this child was brought back to Chicago, he had blood poisoning in one foot.
What the fuck? Okay.
So,
all right.
You might expect, Miles, that when a government agency finds all of this shit out and writes a report on it in 1975, the end of the program would come soon after, as would criminal charges for a lot of the people involved, absolutely. Right? This would be a pretty full episode if this ended in 1975, because we've talked about some bad shit here. But this is the United States of America. I need to remind you of that again, as I did in episode one, Miles. And the Elan School continued to operate for more than 30 years after this point. Because again, parents have a sacred right to pay people to torture their children if they think it's a good idea.
That's unbelievable. So they were just able to skate under that premise?
Well, we're going to talk about how they got away with it. But the core of why they got away with it is there is a widespread idea that is particularly right. normative among conservative Americans that as a parent, you are the ultimate arbiter of what happens to your child. And right. they don't have rights. You have a sacred right to do whatever the fuck you want to that kid is a yeah. punishment, right?
Of course. It's a popular refrain. I'm the adult and
maybe
you are the child.
Children should have equivalent rights to adults, even though we all agree children should not have equivalent responsibilities, maybe shouldn't have access to all of the same things that adults do. For example, I don't think 9-year-olds should be able to buy cars or guns, but perhaps they are entitled to the exact same human rights.
Come on down to Miles's catalytic converter barn where no matter your age, you're walking out of here juiced up, baby.
I think we should be teaching kids because kids can get under the car easily. Their little hands can reach in there.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, we should train. That's Miles. We could start a teen rehab facility where we get kids off of dope by teaching them to steal catalytic converters.
No.
Sophie, no. You always stomp on my dreams to create residential schools for children.
Wait, is this one illegal too? Like the other 15 ideas you said no to, Sophie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She hates it when I talk about crimes.
I like being able to pay my rent.
Well, you could pay your rent in catalytic converters. Just drop a bag of them off at the manager's office, Sophie.
There you go.
No.
You'd be like, hey, here's a bag of cats. That's going to take care of me for the rest of the year, right?
Wink.
Give him a little wink.
No.
If he's smart, he'll take the deal. Mm. So the good news is that the Illinois investigators did take the kids who were wards of the state away from the Elan School. They issued a damning report that includes these lines. Quote, Elan will argue that the evaluation team has taken occurrences out of context and that contrary to the findings of the evaluation team, the incidents were in the best interests of the child. Regardless of the reasons given by Elan, excusing or justifying the incidents, each and every incident reported is directly contrary to Illinois law and regulations, and under no circumstances can the agency permit any of its wards to reside at an institution where such events occur. These practices violate the child's civil rights and liberties and deprive him of his self-respect and dignity. Under no circumstances can the Department of Education and Family Services permit any child to be subjected to Elan, which is good. Good on you, guys who tried in the fucking state of Illinois. I don't have a lot of praise for the state of Illinois, but they did their best.
And so at the very least, that meant no more wards of the state would be going to this program.
Oh, no. Good God, least. No. It just means Illinois won't send kids for a while.
Just for a while.
Well, and just that the state won't. Other kids from Illinois keep getting sent there. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Private citizens can now endlessly indulge in.
Yeah, very little actually changes. And I'm going to talk, we're about to talk about why. So there's a lot of blow about this, right? This becomes very public. The news is like the fucking electric sauce and the beating pits. Like people are not wild about this. But you know what people are wild about, Miles?
The new bottled line of electric sauces from Heinz?
Exactly. Heinz electric sauce. Now with 80% more feces and cum. Squirt it on a child's head when they misbehave. Whatever. Ah, shit.
It's the early days of COVID. April 2020. A woman in a small town in Oklahoma makes a strange post to Facebook and then disappears.
I'm on day 9 of this virus and I am pretty sure it has reached my lungs. I made the decision at the onset that if it got bad enough, I would not go to the hospital.
Pretty quickly, a ragtag group of women on the internet start their own investigation.
It felt like I was living out one of like my fantasy dreams of being a detective.
But the world they uncover is beyond their wildest imagination.
How did this happen?
Listen to What Happened to Talina Czar on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to the 1960s. Mary Pinchot Meyer was a painter who lived in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Every day, she took a daily walk along a towpath near the E&O Canal. So when she was killed in a wealthy neighborhood...
She had been shot twice in the head and in the back, behind the heart.
The police arrived in a heartbeat. Within 40 minutes, a man named Raymond Crump Jr. was arrested. He was found nearby, soaking wet, and he was black. Only one woman dared defend him, civil rights lawyer Dubie Roundtree. Join me as we unravel this story with a crazy twist. Because what most people didn't know is that Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something unexpected happened after Jeremy Scott confessed to killing Michelle Schofield in Bone Valley Season 1.
I just knew him as a kid.
Long, silent voices from his past came forward.
And he was just staring at me.
And they had secrets of their own to share.
Gilbert King, I'm the son of Jeremy Lynn Scott.
I was no longer just telling the story. I was part of it.
Every time I hear about my dad, it's, oh, he's a killer. He's just straight evil.
I was becoming the bridge between a killer and the son he'd never known.
If the cops and everything would have done their job properly, my dad would have been in jail. I would have never existed.
I never expected to find myself in this place. Now, I need to tell you how I got here.
At the end of the day, I'm literally a son of a killer.
Bone Valley, Season 2. Jeremy.
Jeremy, I want to tell you something.
Listen to new episodes of Bone Valley, Season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear the entire new season ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
I found out I was related to the guy that I was dating.
I don't feel emotions correctly.
I am talking to a felon right now, and I cannot decide if I like him or not.
Those were some callers from my call-in podcast, Therapy Gecko. It's a show where I take real phone calls from anonymous strangers all over the world as a fake gecko therapist and try to dig into their brains and learn a little bit about their lives. I know that's a weird concept, but I promise it's pretty interesting if you give it a shot. Matter of fact, here's a few more examples of the kinds of calls we get on this show.
I live with my boyfriend and I found his piss jar in our apartment.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
I have very overbearing parents.
Even at the age of 29, they won't let me move out of their house.
So if you want an excuse to get out of your own head and see what's going on in someone else's head, search for Therapy Gecko on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's the one with the green guy on it.
We're back, and we're talking about how constant exposure to the horrors that this show exposes us to may cause me to make some off-color comments that I ought not.
So I have editors.
We have these moments. I mean, it is like a real problem. We had this with like the Irish Schools episode where I think Sophia and I went a little bit hard on the dark humor because it's so, you just get overwhelmed with this eventually. There's nothing to do but like laugh about the electric sauce, you know?
No, it's like you're like a cat, like someone who's been on the seas too long, like looking sharks in the eye. Like at a certain point, like you're just like, they're kind of, you know, they've seen a lot of.
You ever looked into an Alan school teacher's eyes? Dead eyes. Like a doll's eyes.
Like, okay, sir. Again, I'm just here to take your order.
Yeah, I do have fun with the Wendy's girl. So, Miles, there's this report comes out, right? It's bad. There's a bunch of bad press for the Alan school, and this prompts the governor of Maine to visit the school. Now, obviously, they have warning this time, and they clean up the school ahead of the governor's visit. And he's like, oh, this seems fine. But once he reads the report from Illinois, he has Maine's Department of Human Services issue a very speedy interim report. And the purpose of this report was to protect the Alan school, which had become a multi-million-dollar business, and thus protect Maine's economy as well, right? His concern is this would be bad for Maine's economy if this big business has to leave. Since Richie had warning before this investigation, he tasked his employees with making everything look squeaky clean. One teenage staff member later told Mara Curley, quote, "We lied through our teeth. What we couldn't cover up, we admitted to as the exception rather than the rule. The residents were thrilled when the place was overrun with investigators because they had a real fun time. We laid off everybody then, but everything the Illinois investigators said was true. Every last word of it." Now, the Illinois investigators found a bunch of horrible shit, and they wrote about it very unsparingly. Like, this is a child abuse factory and should be closed immediately. The Maine investigators, who, again, were sent there specifically to exonerate the Alan school to keep money in the state of Maine, found this, quote, "No evidence of unjustifiable denials of civil liberties or of mistreatment, brutality, or anything that could be considered abhorrent to all accepted standards of child care. The residents of Alan interviewed usually expressed newfound feelings of dignity, self-assurance, and mental well-being. They attributed these feelings to the treatment they received at Alan." Responding to the charges of the ring, spankings, and the physical abuse, Maine investigators wrote, "One of the cardinal rules of the Alan program is that the use of physical violence by either a staff member or a resident is strictly outlawed." Again, Joe Ritchie had admitted to the ring. Like, it's just nonsense. It's just a report full of lies. Holy paid shit. For by the government of Maine to keep a business in the state. Probably because Joe Ritchie's bribing people. He does that a lot. He's very involved in politics in Maine because he's a millionaire after a certain point.
Right. Oh my
now,
God.
Since the ring had by this point gone viral as the most terrifying measure in Alan's arsenal, Maine state investigators had to make a declaration on that too. They defended it after writing that violence wasn't used by saying, quote, "Only acts of repeated physical violence result in a person being placed in the ring where rounds last about 1 minute and where the participants are evenly matched." Again, all of this is a lie based on hundreds of reports. Like,
and now they're acting like, oh, but we've made it. The regulations are way better now. We're getting fair ones now. Mm-hmm. We got kids engaging in fair ones, not just straight up.
Even if this was like a
sessions.
School where it's like, well, we only have 1 minute boxing matches for kids. It's like, wait, why do you have children fighting?
Well, okay, but they're matched based on their weight class. Okay.
Yeah. Again, if you do have a boxing class, that's fine. But boxing is a punishment I would call child abuse.
No, absolutely.
Also, we should have a conversation about whether kids should be able to box or play things like football that will damage their brains when they're too young to make an informed decision about whether or not they want to damage their brains. But that's a subject for a different day. Not that you shouldn't be able to box or play football, but maybe not as a child. I don't know. So, since the ring had by this point gone viral as the most terrifying measure in Alan's... Oh, right. I already read that. So, we'll talk more about the ring later. What's important for now was that hundreds of former students have come forward representing decades worth of time at Elon and all claimed that this is bullshit. The report had a bunch of other frustrating nonsense in it, but the gist of it was that Joe Ritchie and his school get a clean bill of not committing crimes against humanity from their host state. They use this to riposte back at Illinois, filing a civil complaint and alleging that the evaluation team had defamed Elon and done $6.1 million in actual damages and $4 million in punitive damages. Illinois filed suit in response, suing in district court and charging that Elon employees had abused wards of the state. They requested damages too. A flurry of lawsuits followed, and in the end, both sides settled without any money going anywhere except into the pockets of lawyers. The state kind of gives up after a point. Because again, these kids are wards of the state. They don't have anyone behind them.
Right.
It's not worth it. Right.
Purely just, statistics.
Because our legal system is perfect. Now, earlier I quoted a teenage staff member, one of the people who was technically an inmate but reached a high position within the program. That person's name was Ken Zaretsky. He was part of the architecture of violence at Elon, organizing the ring, verbally abusing and physically abusing other children, and making sure it all ran smoothly. Years later, he told Mara Curley, quote, "But I was brainwashed. I may have abused someone, but I was a victim too. It can be compared to a mother in the concentration camps pushing the buttons on her children in the ovens. How can you fault her for that?" Now, this is not a thing that ever happened at concentration camps. They just didn't work that way. That's nonsense. Ken didn't have an education, though. So,
yeah. Like, I'm like, what was that
his,
bit of
his broader point? There actually is, if he'd known anything about the Holocaust, there's a better point you can make, which is that a lot of the physical work necessary to make the death camps run was done by Jews who were interned in the camps, right?
Right.
And these were Jewish inmates who got some kind of privileges. More mainly the privilege was that they didn't get killed as quickly, but they were the ones who were like pushing, shoveling the bodies in, like literally making the gas chambers work.
Doing the maintenance.
The poison was always put in by a doctor, but they were necessary to make it work. And these guys did, obviously, even though they're making a concentration camp work, you can't judge them for it. Like, he's right about that. When you are
within the confines of your, and
that point, I think he's right about. If you're a child forced into this and you do horrible things to other kids in order to make your own experience less terrible, because that's what this place is designed to do, you're not really at fault. You know, I think there's a certain point, especially if you grow up and you come back to as an adult, where you become culpable. But like a fucking 16-year-old, like agreeing to beat kids up in the ring because like otherwise you're going to get the shit kicked out of you. Like, I can't. Yeah. It's not.
Then you're going to beat the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Your own self-interest.
Yeah. And in the same way, like if you're forced into a death camp and your chance to avoid getting murdered is to help the death camp operate, you're not morally responsible to that, I would argue.
Sure.
But Zaretsky, again, received no education, so I don't think he knows much about the Holocaust.
You heard some interesting things along the way, I'm sure.
Yeah. So Zaretsky provides us with some interesting context for how the whole system functioned outside of the school itself. He was a private referral sent to Elon by a doctor named Marvin Schwartz. Marvin's nickname was Mr. Adolescent Illinois, which is one of the worst nicknames I've heard about in my life. He is said to have single-handedly built Elon with his private referrals. Schwartz was a friend and colleague of Dr. Davidson, and he received a kickback for every child he sent to Elon. We now know that Dr. Zaretsky was only wrong in his statement that Schwartz built Elon single-handedly. Dr. Davidson was also responsible for referrals, and there were a whole network of other psychiatrists like Dr. Schwartz who knew Dr. Davidson. He would basically go to his friends in other states and be like, "Hey, I got this school. Every time you send a kid to us, I'll kick you a few hundred bucks."
Right.
You know, that's
it adds up.
That's how this place works. And
it's just multi-level marketing for, you know, abuse.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah.
It's in the same, you know, very similar models now.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most fucked up things about the work of those Illinois investigators is that, like, ultimately, you could argue it helped the school because it brought them a bunch of press. And they were able to defend themselves. Journalists went to them for the state. They were able to make statements in their defense. And a lot of people decided, oh, sounds like this tough love approach works. Like, it's just some weak liberals in the Illinois state don't want it to keep going.
So they got more.
Yeah, they got money. And they got to make statements like this to the press. And this is Dr. Davidson speaking to the Corrections Magazine in 1979 about the Illinois investigation. "What happened was we got some conventional middle-aged mental health workers who saw certain things they did not understand. The other thing was that the governor of Illinois at the time was a self-righteous guy who was trying to make political hay by bringing all the juveniles back to the state. They were disrupting things, asking kids, 'Why do you obey?' Now, in the same interview, Joe Ritchie was asked about the Illinois team, and he claimed, "It was a raid from the start. They were very unprofessional. They got drunk at one meal and then came back to Elon to work. I didn't like that." Ritchie would also claim, accurately, that three of the kids removed from Elon by Illinois eventually fled back to the Elon school. He claimed that this was evidence that the program helped those kids. I think it was more evidence that when you abuse someone enough, they can't exist outside of the system of abuse that you built for them, which is why so many kids went to work there as adults. Because you break people in such a way that they can't exist outside of this weird little society you've built in your school. Yeah. Would be my argument. Now, this does, however, bring us to a very valid question. Is there any evidence that Elon's program worked? That 1979 Corrections Magazine article notes that, at the time it was written, Elon had only been doing follow-up checks on former residents for 2 years. They claimed that of the 500 people who'd been admitted to Elon at that point, 326 had been tracked down. Of these, 190 had graduated the program. 78% of these people had stayed out of trouble with the law. On that strength, Elon claimed that nearly 80% of their graduates were successful, right? 80% success rate, basically. Now, that's a lie based on their own data, because they tracked down 326 kids, right? 190 graduate, and they say 78% of these people stayed out of trouble with the law. That makes it a success. But 136 of them didn't graduate, and only 26% of those kids were arrested or jailed again, which means dropouts had an identical success rate to graduates, basically. So number one, that makes it seem like maybe it had nothing, you know, whether or not you graduate the Elon school didn't have anything to do about your success. But Corrections Magazine, in their write-up, gave further reasons to doubt that data. Elon's recidivism figures are so low, especially given the fact that many of their referrals are from state agencies or hardcore delinquents, that most researchers would find them suspicious. Perhaps one explanation is that most of the follow-up was done by questionnaire, without any attempt to confirm the information the former resident supplied through official records. Of the 12 states who refer children to Elon, only 4 have ever done any follow-up, and that was limited and informal. Maryland, Rhode Island, Oregon, and Vermont surveyed a total of 71 former Elon residents. They found that 17% of them were in jail, 17 were working or in school, and 42 were, in the words of one official, living marginal lives that included some petty crime, frequent unemployment, and overuse of alcohol or drugs. So that doesn't sound like a great success rate to me.
Not at all.
It also, again, they're basing this whole no trouble with the law thing. They're basing 80% of our students went on to have, you know, law abiding lives based on self-reporting from those students rather than actually confirming anything. All of their data is bullshit, basically. There's no evidence the school helped any. There's no evidence this school helped anyone. Obviously, individuals will say it helped me, but there's no evidence that, like, as a population, Elon students were less likely to commit crimes or have drug abuse problems than any other group of kids in a similar situation. Yeah,
it's almost like it's a total crock of sadistic shit that wasn't intended to do anything except like make money.
Just a child abuse factory. Rhode Island sent a team of investigators to Elon, who were horrified to find that not only did the business lack a board of directors, it lacked any oversight mechanism to review tactics or employee behavior. The investigators talked to Dr. Davidson and were shocked to find out that he spent no time at the facility and was unable to provide answers about stuff like the ring. There were 3 MA psychologists on staff, but all were recent hires who, like Dr. Davidson, knew nothing about how the school functioned on a daily basis. And some students will claim that, like, those people were protected from knowing anything about the school. They were brought in to do therapy sessions, and, like, you never got to do therapy alone. There would always be a student watching you, so if you said anything, you would get punished. So you would only exactly. They would do this for every visit. You're talking to your parents on the phone. Someone's listening. They'll disconnect it if you say anything bad is going on. We'll talk more about that later. 60% of former residents were later found to have been arrested for criminal violations. They noted that this was likely to be a conservative estimate of failure because criminal records did not reflect child abuse, neglect, mental health institutionalization, or a variety of other factors. So Rhode Island finds 60% of former Elon residents go on to be arrested for something. something, and that more are probably having some sort of issue. It just wasn't reflected by the criminal justice system because they were just beating their own kids, right?
Right.
Like, that's literally what the state says.
Oh my God.
None of these investigations did anything to stop Joe Ritchie or Dr. Davidson from becoming millionaires. Joe and his wife, Sherry, bought a mansion. They got all the status symbols of success, a bunch of fancy cars. But the wealthier Joe gets and the more expansive the Elan school becomes, the more abusive and deranged he gets in his own relationship. I'm going to quote from Duck in a Raincoat again here. In his marriage, Ritchie began employing the techniques he used at Elan. If his wife annoyed or angered him, she'd be punished. One punishment was embarrassment and humiliation in the presence of other staff members. According to one former staffer, he'd shoot her down, an Elan term to describe the taking of authority away from someone who had misused it, by humiliating her at staff meetings, or he'd purposely exclude her from decision-making, instructing people not to tell her something. At first, we were led to believe that they had the perfect marriage, a former resident recalled. But after a while, it was apparent to some of us that it was far from it. Sometimes Ritchie would disappear, and when Sherry called Elan to find him, he wouldn't speak to her, once she was informed that he'd taken a blonde social worker with him to Las Vegas. Yeah, there's a lot to say about, like, his kind of sexual relationships. It doesn't seem like he mostly wanted to fuck. It was just kind of a power thing. He wanted these young women around doing what he was saying. I don't know.
Yikes.
Ritchie would insist on forcing attractive female residents of Elan to act as babysitters for his children. If Sherry complained, he would call her neurotic. One of these nannies later admitted to burning their son with a cigarette. When Sherry complained, Ritchie told her that the staff member had changed, or the resident had changed, and he wasn't being fair to her by not giving her another chance.
Oh my God.
He's a weird, yeah.
Cool.
So Sherry had a number of nervous breakdowns for which she was hospitalized in 1976. While she was in recovery, Joe showed up to present her with a diamond and a sapphire necklace in full view of the nurses in order to, like, make the nurses so the nurses wouldn't believe anything she'd say about him being abusive. Because look, he brought her this necklace. He's the dream husband.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
This looks like the husband of the year. I mean, those are chocolate diamonds by Jane Seymour.
Yeah, like, we're mostly going to focus on the Elan school here and not Ritchie's personal life, but he's just a comprehensively abusive person.
Right.
So,
you know who isn't a comprehensively abusive person unless it's a Koch brothers, Ed?
Yeah, or, I don't know, Volkswagen kind of gaslit all of us with the, like, literally, yeah. Actually, yeah, with the diesel, we were like, with the diesel stuff.
Yeah.
So, unless it's one of those.
Missions to see here.
Yeah, everything's fine.
It's the early days of COVID, April 2020. A woman in a small town in Oklahoma makes a strange post to Facebook and then disappears.
I'm on day 9 of this virus, and I am pretty sure it has reached my lungs. I made the decision at the onset that if it got bad enough, I would not go to the hospital.
Pretty quickly, a ragtag group of women on the internet start their own investigation.
It felt like I was living out one of, like, my fantasy dreams of being a detective.
But the world they uncover is beyond their wildest imagination.
How did this happen?
Listen to What Happened to Talina Czar on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to the 1960s. Mary Pinchot Meyer was a painter who lived in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Every day, she took a daily walk along the towpath near the E&O Canal. So when she was killed in a wealthy neighborhood...
She had been shot twice, in the head and in the back, behind the heart.
The police arrived in a heartbeat. Within 40 minutes, a man named Raymond Crump Jr. was arrested. He was found nearby, soaking wet, and he was black. Only one woman dared defend him, civil rights lawyer Dubby Roundtree. Join me as we unravel this story with a crazy twist. Because what most people didn't know is that Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something unexpected happened after Jeremy Scott confessed to killing Michelle Schofield in Bone Valley Season 1.
I just knew him as a kid.
Long, silent voices from his past came forward.
And he was just staring at me.
And they had secrets of their own to share.
Gilbert King, I'm the son of Jeremy Lynn Scott.
I was no longer just telling the story. I was part of it.
Every time I hear about my dad, is, oh, he's a killer. He's just straight evil.
I was becoming the bridge between a killer and the son he'd never known.
If the cops and everything would have done their job properly, my dad would have been in jail. I would have never existed.
I never expected to find myself in this place. Now, I need to tell you how I got here.
At the end of the day, I'm literally a son of a killer.
Bone Valley, Season 2. Jeremy.
Jeremy, I want to tell you something.
Listen to new episodes of Bone Valley Season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear the entire new season ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
I found out that I was related to the guy that I was dating.
I don't feel emotions correctly.
I am talking to a felon right now, and I cannot decide if I like him or not.
Those were some callers from my call-in podcast, Therapy Gecko. It's a show where I take real phone calls from anonymous strangers all over the world as a fake gecko therapist and try to dig into their brains and learn a little bit about their lives. I know that's a weird concept, but I promise it's pretty interesting if you give it a shot. Matter of fact, here's a few more examples of the kinds of calls we get on this show.
I live with my boyfriend and I found his piss jar in our apartment.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
I have very overbearing parents. Even at the age of 29, they won't let me move out of their house.
So if you want an excuse to get out of your own head and see what's going on in someone else's head, search for Therapy Gecko on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's the one with the green guy on it.
We're back! So Sherry started going to therapy and came to accept how fucked up Joe Ritchie was and how unhealthy their marriage had become. By 1978, they'd filed for divorce. The following year, Joe bought a nearby racetrack. The details of this transaction are sketchy as hell, and it seems like he was involved with the mob. The FBI certainly thought he was.
Yeah.
Also, at one point, the racetrack burnt down conveniently, and he made a bunch of money.
Burn a racetrack down? Just like the stands or whatever? Okay.
Yeah, there's some sort of... Anyway... We're not going to dwell too much on that. I want to tell a couple of stories of other kids who were sent to the Elan School. First, let's talk about Phil Newell. In 1981, Phil's father beat their mother, his ex-wife, nearly to death with a pipe. She spent the next 28 years almost insensate in a nursing home. Phil and his sister became wards of the state and were sent first to a foster home. By 1982, Phil had grown into a sweet but troubled teen. His sister later recalled, "He was beautiful. All the girls liked him, and I remember I used to get mad because that was my brother and I didn't want any girls around him. We were close. We were really close." But he also dealt with fits of anger, which is very understandable and expected from a kid whose mom was beaten so badly by his dad that he had to become a ward of the state, right? Of course, you're going to have some anger issues. And he mostly hurt himself. He would slam his head into walls and such. Migraines seemed to be a trigger for his violence. He had horrible migraines. And at one point during a migraine, he swung his foster brother by the ankles into a couch. Like, he just has a fit and he attacks his foster brother. Not a serious injury, but he gets sent to a youth center as a result of this. And when that didn't work, the state sent him to the Elan School. His sister continues, quote, "We were told Elan was a step up from the youth center because he got transferred and that he was doing well and that everything was going good and that he was going to come home. He came home in a box." So,
oh my God.
At the time when he dies, in like, I think it's 76 is when he dies, she's told that it was an aneurysm, which it was. I mean, it was an aneurysm, but she was just told that he had an aneurysm while he was at the school. And that's what she believed for 33 years, that he had just had a freak aneurysm at this normal school. Until in 2016, a former Elan resident named Mark Babbitts tracked her down. And I'm going to quote from the Sun Journal here. He tracked down Newell and put her on the phone with a witness who said Phil didn't just collapse one day as the family had been told. He'd been forced into Alon's infamous boxing ring and beaten by other teenagers because he complained of a headache. The witness saw Phil collapse, spasm and turn blue. Eventually, staff took him away. He was dead within a day. Now, the Sun Journal spoke with that witness and another, and although some of the details differ, their stories are essentially the same. And it turns out that stories of Phil's death had begun circulating online in communities of Alon survivors starting in 2003. The first reference to his death came from a friend of his who said that on Christmas weekend, Phil was forced to go 3 rounds in the ring before he passed out and started vomiting. He lay on the floor for an hour before being given medical attention. Another former student, Ann Bowen, gave a slightly different story. She agreed that they thought he was manipulating the system by pretending to have a headache, so they put him in the ring. And basically, the only difference with her argument is that, like, she doesn't recall him passing out at first. He was just, like, walked away from the ring having, like, head issues and then eventually collapsed.
But he definitely
collapsed.
Went into the ring for having a migraine.
Yeah, he went into the ring for having a migraine, was beaten, and died soon after. Yeah. And again, possible he would have died without the ring, but also possible that if, for example, they'd treated his migraines seriously, he might have gotten medical care or something.
Yeah.
Or at least wouldn't have had his last experience before death getting beaten by a bunch of children in a ring. So there was an investigation into Phil's death, but it occurred so late and 5 years after Alon itself closed that nothing conclusive came of it. It is worth noting that this network of former students who are the reason that his sister finds out about this were eventually what brings the Alon school down. They start to organize in like the early 2000s and whatnot, and then carry out a campaign to report this place. It was a long process, like killing the Alon school, and it took years and years and years to do. Meanwhile, throughout the 80s and 90s, Alon saw hundreds and hundreds of new students. Joe Ritchie ran for governor of Maine several times. He never quite pulled it off, but he was very influential in the state. Research for this episode was actually sparked by a graphic novel I found online called Joe Versus Alon School. It was written by a former student who goes by Joe Nobody. He went to Alon in the 1990s, and I really recommend his story to everyone. It's a fascinating graphic novel, and it gives a lot of context on how the school had evolved by that point. The electric sauce was gone by then, and safety gear in the ring was at least more common, but the whole experience was just as brutal. Solitary confinement had been added to the repertoire, and kids could be sentenced to months of being forced to live and sleep within the confines of a space roughly the size of a broom closet. The goal was to break you. Because solitary confinement does that to people, so you'd be desperate enough to yield to the program just to get human contact again. In fact, over the course of the 1980s, the strict hierarchy of jobs within Alon evolved for a dual purpose. It existed to police behavior and ensure that everyone was watching everyone else, and it existed to encourage people to buy into the system by working for better positions in order to get more privileges. For more on that, I want to quote from a Reddit post I found from a former student. Education was considered a right, but those of us who earned the right were still robbed of an education. School was from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. No homework, no tests, no projects. Example, math class consisted of grabbing a math book and handing the teacher at least one page of work. You're just supposed to read through the book and, like, write a page of stuff. Like, here's it was never graded. It was never, you didn't learn anything, right?
It was all like so basically pantomime.
Mm-hmm. We have to have these kids in a room with like a teacher who just, I don't know, is probably an alcoholic living in the middle of nowhere and isn't going to care. Yeah.
Right.
Now, the other 12 hours of the day consisted of constant conditioning and brainwashing. In the beginning, you obviously rejected it, but then you would be dealt with. You would not be able to rise through the ranks of the program to earn more rights until you could prove yourself to be a good candidate for more brainwashing. Eventually, it became your responsibility to begin indoctrinating the newer residents, basically you, 6 months later, or 6 months earlier. You had strength and non-strength. Non-strengths were not allowed to talk, interact, or communicate in any way with other non-strengths. It took a minimum of 6 months to earn the title of strength. It took some kids years to earn strength. Some kids never did. Alon made money based on the amount of time it took for you to graduate the program. You had to have a minimum of 7 promotions before you were a candidate for graduation. Each promotion took a minimum of 3 months, and 90% of the kids never made it past the 5th promotion. These kids had to wait until they turned 18 and could legally sign themselves out. Other kids stayed past their 18th birthday, which is a true testament to the effectiveness of the brainwashing. I remember one dude was 23. And some of them didn't have a choice. This wasn't all brainwashing. If you're sent there at 17 or 16, because you broke a law, if you don't graduate, you go to prison.
Right.
So you and they can keep you there as long as they want because they decide when you're ready to graduate.
Right. Unless you. And then again, just like even with incarcerated people, it's like if you're treated a certain way, sometimes you know no other way to live except within there. And
yikes. And keeping kids after age 18 wasn't only a matter of brainwashing. Joe, who wrote that graphic novel, did eventually yield to the program after escaping. He escaped at one point and got to as far as New York City before being captured. And he spent months in solitary after that. So he eventually just buys into the program because he can't stand how miserable his life is in solitary, right? Like he has to. Now, his plan was to sign himself out when he turned 18. He didn't care about graduating. But before that day came, he had a call with his parents. Now, I should note here that according to Joe and other students, phone calls and visits with parents were tightly controlled. They would end the call if you seemed to be about to say anything negative about the Elon School. Elon administrators carefully choreographed parent visits and coached parents ahead of time, preparing them for the idea that their child might lie to get out of a program that they desperately needed to be in.
Oh, my God. Of course.
Now, students could have visits back home with their families if they earned them, but during those visits, higher strength students were sent with them to police their behavior. So you're never alone with your parents and have a chance to convince them of what's being done to you. So Joe's about to turn 18 and he gets a call from his parents and they've been talking to the administrator who says he's doing great, but that he really needs to graduate the program. And they tell him, if you leave when you turn 18, we'll cut you off from any financial assistance, any college funds, whatever, because we love you and we've been told this is best for you. By the way, Joe was sent to Elon because at 16, he and some friends got arrested with weed. Like, I'm going to talk more about Joe's story in a bit, but before we get to that, I want to read you the story of another student. Tatiana Karam attended Elon from 1996 to 1998, and in her case, the fact that she was sent there by her parents was the result of a tragic error. From the New York Times, quote, Ms. Karam, a student at the Northeastern University in Boston, said she was sent to Elon from her home in Dubai after her parents, who were looking for an American school that would shelter her from Western sexual mores, saw a school brochure featuring idyllic photographs of the outdoors and students on horseback. At one point, when her parents sent a fax to the school saying they planned to pick up their daughter, Ms. Karam said she was pressured to call them and ask for more time at the school. When she refused, a school official called her parents and told them their daughter was not ready to leave. It was only after she left Elon, Ms. Karam said, that she was able to give them the details. My mother, when she found out what happened, was so disgusted, Ms. Karam said. She tells me she's sorry all the time. Like, that was just a freak nightmare accident in her case. Like, Jesus.
They got just do, yeah, it's like,
they're not, they're not Americans. Like, they don't, they can't vet it maybe as much. They don't speak the language. They think they're doing the nice thing for their kid. She winds up there. Yeah. She backs up a lot of the details about like phone calls being monitored and all of that stuff. Now, one of the things that's amazing about Joe's story is that he escaped for a while. Now, Elon had an intricate system to stop escapees. They had men in the woods waiting for people who might flee. But Joe got away. He went on a visit with his parents and another kid, and he maced his parents and the other kid and fucking ran for it.
Oh, my God. Wait, and you're saying there are people just stationed in the perimeter woods?
Yeah.
Like in like a hunting blind almost?
Yeah, kind of,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, here to sweep up any runaways.
Yeah. Yep.
Holy shit.
So he gets away, he escapes and he's in the woods and he finds a guy, and there's a couple of cases. There's another dude in a documentary who escaped into the woods and met like a crazy hermit out there who had just been living off grid. And like this guy just adopted him and taught him. And now that dude, the kid who escaped, is like a wilderness survival instructor. Like he just spent years living alone with this guy in the woods of Maine outside of civilization and stuff.
After escaping.
Yeah, after escaping.
School?
Yeah. He's in a documentary called The Last Stop. It's fucking amazing. Like he's just like, I was just lost in the woods and I meet this guy who's like living off the land and he just teaches me how. Which is actually rad.
Yeah. And like in my mind, like that guy had also escaped to like an Elon school and like, but you're, and
they've
this
got
guy
their
was
own
just
civilization.
Like, okay, I understand young man, I'll give you the skills to live out here. What a fucking story.
No, so Joe gets away and he's in the woods and he probably would have gotten caught again, but he found this drifter in a van who drives up. And like the way Joe recalls the story in his graphic novel, he's like certain he's going to be raped. And this guy like is clearly doing a drug deal. Like they stop in Boston, pick up a huge bag of something, and then the guy has a bunch of cash. But like the guy, like, again, Joe is like really worried about this guy at first and thinks like something horrible is going to happen. But the dude just winds up giving him a bunch of cash and saying like, good luck. Don't get, you know, caught again. Like apparently just like a nice man who is just doing some drug smuggling, but realized this kid's in a bad place and needs some help. So he made it to New York City. But after a day or so, he gets spotted by employees of the Daytop School because Joe Ritchie had put out a bolo for his missing student. And he gets kidnapped again and dragged back to Maine. He was literally like trussed up in the back of a van. And at one point when they get back into Maine, they stop at a gas station and he gets the attention of a cop who immediately assumes this is a kidnapping and like starts to like try to arrest the guys for kidnapping him. But Joe claims that the men kidnapping him gave the cop Joe Ritchie's name, and the officer's attitude completely changed, right? Because this guy is a millionaire. He's bought a lot of politicians in the area. Now, I can't tell you that Joe Ritchie was bribing the cops because I don't know that he was. Right. But that's what this kid claims, and that like the cop, and there's others. There's at least one story, a fucked up story of a cop encountering an Elan runaway. And it's this guy, Max Ashburn, this police lieutenant, like picks this kid up, and he'd been hearing fucked up stories about the Elan school for years from like former inmates and from just people in the area, and had been kind of sketched out by it, but like also couldn't do anything about it because, again, they're a very powerful force in the community. So he picks this kid up, this runaway, and he's supposed to hand this kid back to the Elan school. Legally, that's his job. But he's so horrified by this kid's story that he drives the kid to a truck stop and hands him off to a random group of truckers. And is just like, someone here will take you away. Best thing this police lieutenant can think to do is like, I'm just going to hand the kid to some truckers. It's better than sending him back to Elan school.
What a fucking binary to choose between.
Yeah, which suggests that this guy assumed there was nothing that the law was going to do about this school.
Right, like that you're even in your capacity as a lieutenant.
Yeah, my best option is hand this kid to random truck drivers.
I don't know, these truck drivers seemed nice enough.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe Ritchie's story does not get a lot happier after the 90s. At least that's I guess the good thing is he is pretty miserable, it seems. His drug abuse seems to become an increasing problem. At one point he has like this, he goes on a rant over the PA system at his horse track against a Maine racing official. He sued 3 times for sexual harassment and once for threatening to kill a female employee. He dies in 2001 at age 54. The harm caused by Elan lives on, and it's here I should note that you can find a number of people, again, who will say that the school helped them. More common are people who will say the program made them into the person they are today, but also left them with lasting trauma. And Joe's story, which I really recommend reading in Joe versus Elan School, makes it clear that this could teach children very specific kinds of strength and coping strategies. You get smart in a very specific way to survive a place like this. They're not necessarily good for living in the rest of the world. Now, I've made a conscious choice not to read any of the positive stories about Elan here for a couple of reasons. They are dwarfed, absolutely buried by the horror stories. And two, I don't think the fact that some kids later were like, I think I benefited from this experience, makes it less criminal. I do want to cite, before we go, the story of Stephen Smith. He was 15 years old when a Connecticut social worker sent him to Elan. He'd been a ward of the state since age 6, when his mom was convicted of armed robbery. Stephen was sent to Elan after his neighbor kicked his dog, and he responded by shooting him in the butt with a pellet gun. His social worker gave him the choice of jail or Elan, which she framed as a summer camp in the woods. From the beginning, he had trouble with the Elan system and was subjected to numerous haircuts and general meetings. Quote, They'd asked me if I hated my mother. They'd read my file in front of everyone in the group, things about my mother and her criminal record. I didn't dig that, so I just didn't say anything. Then when I shut up, they accused me of intimidating the group, said I was doing some violent act against group members for not opening up. So everyone, once in a while, they'd set up a general meeting and then throw me in the boxing ring until I lost. I tried to run away all the time. It's the only thing I ever did. Tried to run away every chance I got. I tried about 7 times, but they always caught me because they had this posse that would go out and be rewarded by Richie if they caught someone trying to run away. Now, Stephen Smith said that the first time he met Joe was at a general meeting called by a staff member named Jeff Gottlieb. Here's what he said about that day. Richie came in and I was called out, along with a girl named Nancy and another girl, Marie, two guys, Ray and Johnny, and another kid named Sean. We were all sitting around a table and Richie announced, "We have some cancer in this house, and any good surgeon knows the way to get rid of cancer is to cut it out before it spreads." Then he called us all up in front of the house and asked for everyone if they had any feelings for us. Then Richie says, "Now we're going to put you upstairs in one of the rooms." It was a room about the size of a cell. They boarded up the windows and the door and locked it. Richie said, "Whatever goes on in there goes on." It was July. I know it was in July because it was my 16th birthday the next day. It was horrible. Six of us all stuck in there together. The guys, Ray and Johnny, would take turns beating each other. Ray would pound his head until he got tired, and then they'd take turns having sex with the two girls. One of them didn't care, but the other girl didn't want to, but they made her. Sean and Ray would keep her food, and that's how they got her. The day I turned 16, I mentioned it was my birthday. Sean picked me up and said, "Oh, it's your birthday. I have something to give you." He started to hit me in the face and stuff, and then, well, he raped me in there.
Oh my God.
Yeah. There are other stories of rape. There are other stories of rape at the Elan School. I'm not going to just go through and read them all. What I do want to read is, so Stephen later gets arrested. He goes to prison as an adult, right? And when he was interviewed by the author of Duck in a Raincoat, he was asked how Elan School compared to maximum security prison, which is where he was incarcerated at the time of the interview. Quote, "Elan's much worse. Here there's a lot of shit, but I get a chance for some solitude, to read, and I'm going to college, and I've also gotten to learn woodworking and make some money in the prison store. At Elan, there was nothing positive. It was pure hell. You know, the worst thing is the judge that sentenced me there for 10 years lectured me, telling me I blew the opportunity I had at Elan. I don't understand how the courts can legitimize a guy like Richie, who has harmed so many mixed up kids."
What the fuck?
Yeah. Now, there's also, I mean, it's pretty bad, right, Miles? Not great.
And he's just fucking out here still?
No, he dies in 2001.
Okay, I think the thing cut out.
Yeah, no, he dies in 2001. The school shuts down in 2011. After the last 10 years or so, it's gradually degrading. There's a campaign from a bunch of former students to shut it down. And like the state of New York does goes after them to some extent. Like, it's a process, but it finally closes its doors in 2011. And there's, you know, there's more. There's so much more, dude. Like, there's stories that Joe Richie and other staff slept with teenage girls that were incarcerated at the school. Like, obviously he did shit like that. It's just a bottomless well of horror. I think it's best to end with a quote from Stephen Smith, which I think acts as a fine eulogy both for Joe Richie and for the Elan School. "The most important thing is that the truth comes out about Richie. He has no business screwing up kids and making a fortune doing it. The state takes kids from messed up families, but they put them in places worse. If I was not messed up before I got to Elan, I certainly was afterwards." Oof. Good stuff.
Yeah. And I think, important to keep in mind that we still have things like this.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton of others. Like,
into now. Yeah. Yeah.
There's still the teen... troubled teen industry is a huge business. Every year there's a bill thrown into Congress to try to regulate it, and every year the Republicans make sure that nobody's going to be voting on that motherfucker. How do you feel, Miles?
Oh man, thoroughly fucked, to be honest. But I think I think it gives some layer of context to understanding like these schools that exist, like, mm-hmm. and what that this is part. It's not just sort of like, it doesn't end with this thing we just talked about. Like, this is still continuing. So in a way, I'm in a very broad sense, I'm grateful for the awareness that I have on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But it's doesn't make it any less completely horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's good stuff. I don't know, Miles. What do you do about this industry? Like, how do you actually? I don't know. It just feels hopeless because there's so many people have a vested financial interest in it continuing to exist.
And this like culture of like coercion and power that we exist in, like, it's just it allows for that sort of dimension of our culture to like manifest in like the ugliest fucking way too. I mean, honestly, I feel like more than anything, people, I think We just need to be comparing everything to this school so people have an idea of like truly like what it means to help someone. Not in like the sense that you got from like your grandparents who were like mainlining like Kellogg books, and like that kind of philosophy, and actually like what it means for someone to develop what, you know, cycles and patterns of abuse look like and how to interrupt those and end those. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'll just stick to smoking weed and talking about reality TV.
For now. And I think I'm, I don't know. It's just, you know, I started to make kind of like my bones in journalism. Some of the first stories I did were with like people who had gone to these teen, back when I was still working at Cracked, these teen, troubled teen schools. And it just keeps going on, right? Like the central problem, like the Elon school is fascinating because you've got this uniquely fucked up guy and he builds this uniquely fucked up system for abusing children. But the whole reason why it's able to exist at all is there's this broad agreement with a lot of people in American culture that it would be fundamentally evil to take away a parent's right to choose absolutely everything for their child. And that child doesn't get a say, but the parent is the sovereign of their child. And I think that's bad. I don't think parents should be the unquestioned sovereign of children. I don't think the state should be either. I don't entirely know what the solution to this is, but clearly there are problems with the way we do it.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, you can fundamentally create laws or at least guardrails to what you cannot do or things that we can all agree on that a child should not experience, no matter what the prerogative is of a parent.
Like, I'm certainly not saying we should give the state more power over kids instead of the parents. We should limit parents' power, certainly to do this, right? Can we agree you don't have the right to hire men to kidnap your children into the woods?
Right, and then turn a blind eye to abuse because for whatever reason you feel that that's the solution to your inability to do something or whatever. It's very complex but so simple at the same time, because I think most people can say children do not deserve any kind of existence like that.
Yeah, absolutely. No one does. Like, I wouldn't be supportive of this. If I thought we should have prisons, I wouldn't want them to work this way, because this is not rehabilitating people. This is just hurting them and making them more dangerous to everyone.
I think because, you know, to address this, we'd fundamentally have to address like a lot of these societal ills that we have, like that are deeply ingrained in our psyches and our culture. And that's what it takes. It takes this like tremendous reckoning to have to say, like, you know, we're still manifesting these cycles of abuse infinitely in every single way. And like, it's weird that we can find these rationalizations in our minds, whether it's like you broke the law, quote unquote, and that's why you deserve this, or a parent is the one who decides what's best for their children. You mind your child, I'll mind my, I'll mind mine, sort of thing. That, you know, will it keeps going on. But
I mean, I think the ultimate solution, Miles, is that we should adopt nationwide my program of hollowing out the center of the United States, take all children away from their parents and make them live in the middle of the country as a big open air child prison where they just grow feral and either survive or thrive based on their skills. They
based can form on their crude TikTok, pacts. TikTok views.
No internet, nothing but like sharpened sticks and bows and arrows.
That's where I'm got a little more modern take. See, and this is where people are seeing the schism in the Zoom lady cult. Where you believe the massive crater in the middle should be technologically free, mine should be technologically advanced and TikTok based.
Well, I think TikTok will come into mine when they turn 18, they have to be brought back into society and adults get to hunt them on helicopters. And you can put that on TikTok. Shooting kids with dart guns and they run in their feral packs and then dragging them back to San Bernardino where they work as accountants for 4 years before being declared dentists. Adults. We can talk about dentists. We can talk. Miles.
But Miles, it's time for your pluggables.
Me? Goodness me. Check me out talking news on Daily Zeitgeist every day with your former coworker at Cracked, Jack O'Brien. And, you know, if you like Weed, and 90 Day Fiancé. Check out my reality show podcast, 420 Day Fiancé, with Sophie Alexandra.
Yeah.
That's always a good time. That's not the only bummers we have, or maybe some of the bad accents we'll do sometimes, but it's good times over there.
Well, that's
that is the episode.
Something unexpected happened after Jeremy Scott confessed to killing Michelle Schofield in Bone Valley Season 1.
Every time I hear about my dad, it's, oh, he's a killer. He's just straight evil.
I was becoming the bridge between Jeremy Scott and the son he'd never known.
At the end of the day, I'm literally a son of a killer.
Listen to new episodes of Bone Valley Season 2 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's April 2020. A woman announces on Facebook that she has COVID and won't be seeking medical attention.
I didn't want to be talked out of this plan.
Then she disappears.
Anyone else think this is strange?
I just had to know. How did this happen?
Listen to What Happened to Talina Czar on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Soledad O'Brien, and on my new true crime podcast, Murder on the Towpath, I'm taking you back to 1964, to the cold case of artist Mary Pinchot Meyer.
She had been shot twice, in the head and in the back.
It turns out Mary was connected to a very powerful man.
I pledge you that we shall neither commit nor provoke aggression.
John F. Kennedy. Listen to Murder on the Towpath with Soledad O'Brien on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I found out I was related to the guy that I was dating.
I don't feel emotions correctly.
I collect my roommate's toenails and fingernails.
Those were some callers from my call-in podcast, Therapy Gecko. It's a show where I take phone calls from anonymous strangers as a fake gecko therapist and try to learn a little bit about their lives. I know that's a weird concept, but I promise it's very interesting. Check it out for yourself by searching for Therapy Gecko on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an iHeart Podcast.